This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Health and Living. It is, we're a couple of days away from Chinese New Year and we have a great topic today. We're talking about fertility and in the studio with us, the very beautiful Dr. Helena Lim, our fertility specialist. You know, in an article published in the British Medical Journal, the UK's Human Fertilisation and Embryology Authority, HFEA they're called, they've called for more transparency over add-on fertility treatments. What does that mean? We're going to go through a refresher and have Dr. Helena walk us through the whole process so that you'll know what to expect when seeking fertility treatment and what are these add-ons that the HFEA is actually referring to. Welcome to the show, Dr. Helena. How are you today?
Thank you very much, Mira, for having me again.
Yes, and before Chinese New Year, look at you all dressed up for Chinese New Year.
Yeah. I'm excited to be here.
Yes. I mean, having children and all of that is a big thing, you know,
it is.
In all our communities and for all of them, for all of the Chinese people who are aspiring to have a child in the year of the boar, I'm sure fertility treatment is going to be one of them that they're going to be looking
absolutely,
out for.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah? Let's go through, Dr. Helena. Could you walk us through the fertility treatment process? Let's start from scratch, using IVF is one of the most common fertility treatments.
Sure.
How do patients get an appointment? What should they expect in their first visit? Can you walk us through that?
Yeah, when patients come to see us, usually they would have tried naturally for some time. So usually the most common ones will be somewhere between about 2 to 3 years or 3 to 5 years. So when they come to see us, the complaint is that, okay, I want to have a baby, but we have tried for so XYZ number of years and I can't have one. So can you tell us what is the problem and how can we overcome the problem? So the first thing that we do is take a good history. Now, history will be taken from both the husband and the wife, because a lot of people have this misconception thinking that infertility is actually a women's problem.
All the time.
Mm-hmm. Women get blamed for being so-called infertile. But in actual fact, we know that about 50% of the cause of infertility is actually due to male factors.
As well.
That's mm-hmm. right. So very important to take good history from the husband and the wife.
But how often do the husbands come in? Are they always open to coming in?
Well, most of the time you will see, I think there's been a changing trend, but in those days when I first started doing fertility work, you'll find that mostly it will be the women who come for the first visit. But for over the last few years that you can see a very big changing trend. I think that is because the general public is actually more aware that it's not a one party's problem. Mm-hmm. It's actually both parties' problem.
Okay. If you have a question for Dr. Helena on fertility, send us a WhatsApp message, 018-789-8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. So let's look at the clinical consultation. You look at history, number
yes,
one.
That's right.
Very important. What about the others? Counseling, perhaps, financial consultation, it's not cheap.
Yes, exactly. So what happened is that there is actually some form of I know that every clinic is a little bit different, but it doesn't run away from the core. So what happened, of course, we examine them and we run some investigation to make sure that to ascertain what are the causes for subfertility. Both the men and the women. So it will involve blood works for both men and women and also a sperm test. For women, there may be 2 or 3 other scans that we need to do to look at the ovarian reserves, counting the number of eggs they have in their ovaries, looking at the lining of the uterus, and also to look at whether they are ovulating naturally or not. So these are the simple tests that we do. Now, blood tests for women involve hormonal tests, and there are now some other hormones that we measure, such as anti-Müllerian hormone, to look at what is their ovarian reserve and so forth. Mm-hmm. So after, and certainly an X-ray at the end to look at the fallopian tube, it's also important to know that whether the woman's fallopian tube is actually open or not. So these are the basic few tests that we do. So after completion of all these tests, then you have a conclusion where the problem lies and is there any way that we can fix it? Now, a lot of people come into our door thinking that the first thing that the doctor is going to suggest to them is IVF. Mm-hmm. In fact, that's not right, because we know that most of the time, you know, with certain alteration in their body condition, sometimes these couples can get pregnant naturally as well. So it's not that there is a misconception of people thinking that when they come to the fertility center, it will mean that an IUI or IVF and so forth. In actual fact, it is not.
Okay. And in what percentage is it usually? This intervention is not really needed.
I would say probably at least about 10 to 20% of them, we do get them pregnant.
And why haven't they gotten pregnant?
Well, there are some of them have certain small little thing that you can tweak. For example, some women are not ovulating properly, or they are trying naturally out of the fertile period. They didn't know that this is their fertile window. So by doing a scan, you roughly will figure out when is the best time to try naturally. And let me give you another example. Things like such as vitamin D deficiency, for example. Mm-hmm. It reduces the chance of you getting pregnant naturally if you have vitamin D deficiency, So if you actually replace vitamin D, sometimes you'll find that they get pregnant naturally.
And I would personally suggest that everybody check for vitamin D deficiency, because I just found out that I am vitamin D deficient.
So am I.
So there are many of us walking around with this deficiency. You just want to go and do a quick blood test. And even just for generally, even if it doesn't mean that you want to get pregnant, but just for general health, you want to make sure you have enough vitamin D.
Yeah, you're right. Because certainly when we now know a little bit more about vitamin D, if you have vitamin D deficiency, it is associated with a higher risk of breast cancer, for example. Mm. So there you go.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Load up on it.
Load on it.
Some of us are just not absorbing it, I'm guessing. Yeah. Sometimes it's not even being absorbed, and we're all sitting indoors. So
absolutely.
It's not surprising at all. Financial consultation. Yes. How do you go through that with them?
Now, what happened is that after all this investigation, then we make a conclusion, for example, well, we probably need to try one or two IUIs before IVF and so forth. So we do take them on a financial consultation and look at, you know, things like, these are the expected costs and, what happens if it's not successful, if you were to proceed to another treatment, you know, this is a possible cost and so forth. So the couples actually make a lot of decision when it comes to fertility treatment financial consideration is one of the key factors. A lot of times, patients can turn around. Sometimes we feel that they may actually be able to get away with IUI. But when they look at the percentage of pregnancy with IUI, they can turn around and say, "Doctor, I think this is not worth my time or money. I think I will want to go straight to IVF. I certainly will not be obstructive when it comes to that. Because when you take into consideration that, the cost effectiveness. So these are all the things that we do tell them during our consultation.
Okay. I mean, isn't it sad if people can't afford it, Dr. Helena? I mean, isn't...
It is very sad.
It is expensive.
It is. It is certainly. I don't deny that. But certainly, we feel that IVF should be made available for everyone. Certain countries, they made it a part of their national health provisions.
Yes, I was just going to ask you whether you think that's something Malaysia should consider.
Yes, if we are financially viable, why not? Yeah, I think it's a very important factor, and especially when our fertility rate is actually falling. And we're going to struggle with an aging population later on. So I think that's a very important aspect to consider. Mm-hmm.
And the fact that many of us are getting married later.
Absolutely.
And the fact that we're not the healthiest.
Yes. In our
productive years.
Absolutely.
Okay. So a lot going against us.
Absolutely.
Counselling.
Yes, okay. So counselling is, again, a very important aspect of fertility treatment. But a lot of us in the Eastern society, in Asian society, when we put a patient through a counsellor, for example, they will think that, hey, I'm not having a disease, I'm not cuckoo, I'm not crazy.
Yeah.
So why should I see a counsellor? But they fail to understand that the role of counsellor is actually to gently hold their hands and to actually help them to debrief and also reduces their stress. And certainly these counsellors are trained psychologists and they are able to identify things, for example, marital conflicts or, you know, family conflicts that can potentially create stress to prevent a successful pregnancy.
So do you recommend counselling?
Yes, I do.
At what stage?
Usually, at my, in my practice, I have a fertility counsellor, a psychologist, who is actually sitting in my clinic.
Mm-hmm.
So in some certain patients that where we identify there is actually a lot of stress, for example, multiple IVF failures before, prior to seeing us, for example, or they have issues with marital issues and so forth, we usually would refer them to the fertility counsellor. We also have one specific group of patients who have difficulty in having sexual intercourse, for example, vaginismus. Sometimes a fertility counsellor can be helpful in this kind of scenario.
And vaginismus is when you have a lot of pain.
Yes, during sexual intercourse and so forth. So you can't have a proper sexual intercourse.
It becomes a psychological barrier.
Correct. Yeah.
And when you talk about counselling, can you explain to me, and a lot of people don't understand, the impact of your mental state and your ability to, get pregnant, for an example. What is that link?
Well, it's very hard to, you know, quantify because it's very hard to quantify individual stress because what stresses me might not stress in another person. So it is very hard to quantify how much stress you have and what is the outcome and an impact on your fertility. But certainly we know that fertility is actually a whole mechanism of your hormones, your stress, your well-being, and how you ovulate has a lot to relate, a lot to do with all this, these hormones and how your body's condition is. So stress certainly throws your body off, throws your hormones off. And we notice that when women are very stressed, for example, those who are training for marathon, who are having exam and so forth, we find that they don't ovulate properly.
What do you mean by ovulate properly? I just thought ovulation means the egg coming and dropping into your uterus, and if it's not fertilized, it just comes out as period.
Yeah.
So how does it not ovulate properly?
Meaning that they don't ovulate at all, for example,
okay.
Or the egg don't actually grow at all. And then what happens is that their period is actually out of whack. And we know that even though that we have the studies have shown that 95% of women who are having normal regular menses does ovulate, but there are 5% of women, although they have regular menstrual cycle, they don't ovulate at all.
No eggs.
No eggs at all. So that goes, yeah.
And where's the menstruation playing a part in what?
Okay, so what happens is that when you have menses, it's usually 2 weeks after ovulation.
Yes.
So when you ovulate, the corpus luteum actually gives rise to progesterone. It thickens out your lining of the uterus.
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't get pregnant during that 2 week window, what happens is that the corpus luteum will die off, the progesterone gets withdrawn, and then you have your menses.
Yep.
But in certain patients, when they don't ovulate, they don't have progesterone level. But what happens is the estrogen level will continue to rise and continue to thicken the uterus lining. But what happens after a while is that the wall gets so thick that it cannot hold on. So your menses come.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's very, I know that a lot of people think that, as long as I have menses, I am ovulating properly, I'm fertile. That's not true, entirely true.
When do you reckon teenagers or young ladies should come and see an obstetrician and gynecologist?
In terms of their fertility?
Yes. I mean, just for a check to see if everything's all right, you know, that kind of thing.
I would say that we should actually start to see your gynecologist at the age of probably 25. And if you're sexually active, you should actually start doing things like pap smear, have your yearly scan to make sure that everything works clockwise. I think that is actually important for, you know, our modern living because we know that there are higher incidence of polycystic ovary syndrome nowadays,
mm-hmm.
uterus fibroid, and adenomyosis, endometriosis, and so forth. Again, early intervention, early recognition and intervention is the key point.
Okay, so yeah. 25, and if above. You have been sexually active even yeah. before, then you may want to go and consult somebody just That's to right. be on the safe side. Okay, yep. We're discussing fertility treatment. In the UK, the Human Fertilisation and Embryology Authority has called for more transparency over add-on fertility treatments. We haven't come to that yet. We'll come
Not quite yet.
to that right after this break on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome to Health and Living. I'm Mira Sivasothi. In the studio with me, Dr. Helena Lim, fertility specialist. We are discussing, do fertility add-ons add up? Well, mm-hmm. this is based on an article in the British Medical Journal. We're coming to that, but we're going through the basics of, you know, walking. Dr. Helena is walking us through the basics of IVF. We spoke about cost just now. And Azimi Azmin is asking, what are the factors that go into costing of IVF? Why is it such an operation is not affordable to couples?
Well, the thing is, there are many aspects of IVF which is expensive. Okay, to start with, the injections that we give to women for 10 to 12 days, they are expensive. The reason why we give this injection to the women is to stimulate all their eggs to grow simultaneously. Now, what happened? We are actually overcoming a natural tendency. In the natural cycle, if I don't give injection to a woman, our ovaries will actually produce a batch of follicles. However, in nature form, what happens is that our body will only choose one egg to grow. And the egg will grow to a certain size of maturity and ovulation occur. Then the rest of the follicles just die off. So I sometimes jokingly tell patients' husbands to say that, you know, we women is exactly like, you know, buying 10 pairs of shoes and only, you know, wear one. Yeah. And that is our nature, actually. God made us this way. So if your wife do that, please don't blame her. Yeah.
So that is to boost egg supply.
That's right. So the injection actually overcomes this natural tendency to make all the eggs grow. So that's the first time, the first part of the cost.
And that injection is, they're actually hormones?
Yeah, there's a hormonal okay. injection. So the next part of it is actually operating theatre and the anaesthetist, for example, and anaesthesia fees and drugs and so forth to actually take out the eggs. Now the biggest cost come in, whereby we need to use your eggs and your husband's sperm and then fertilize them in the lab. Now, it is being done by an embryologist who are the scientists who are trained to do so. Now, hiring a scientist is actually not cheap. The medium that we use during egg collection and culturing the embryos are not cheap either. The incubators, the equipments that you use are not cheap either. And furthermore, nowadays, to actually increase the success rate and to improve pregnancy rate, the IVF labs are now very, very advanced. You need very clean room with filters to actually ensure very good air quality to improve the pregnancy rate and the quality of the embryos as well. So all this come with a price. And certainly because throughout the world nowadays, the authority in many countries are now putting in more and more requirement to actually build a lab, a good IVF lab. Mm-hmm. So that makes the costing of building an IVF lab being very, very expensive. And sadly, this kind of cost will need to be passed on to the patients. So these are the issues that we face in the world of fertility. Now, of course, certainly we hope that in time to come, the production of the hormones will become cheaper, the production of medium, culture medium will become cheaper, equipment become cheaper, then there is hope to reduce the cost of IVF, actually.
So the embryologist is the person who's going to pick the best egg and the best sperm and bring it together?
Yeah, we're waiting for AI and robots.
Anything that can be done?
I would think so. I would suspect so, yeah. So we had this very interesting conversation about, will AI ever, replace me?
Yes.
Yeah.
I don't think so, Dr. Helena. They won't look as good as you, that's to start off with.
Oh, thank you very much, Mira.
Let's talk about egg collection, right? Yeah. So how are the eggs collected? You said it's a procedure to go in and take it out. That,
yes.
That requires the operation theatre.
Yes, that's
as
right.
Well as the anaesthetist.
Yes, that's right.
Because collecting the egg isn't as easy as collecting the sperm.
Exactly. Yes, absolutely. I agree with that. All right. So what happens that when you're, after injection of hormones for 10 to 12 days, when we scan the patient and we when we measure the follicles and we are happy with the size of the follicle, so we'll give a patient a, what we call a triggering shot. The triggering shot actually matures the egg 36 hours prior to egg collection. So it has to be, you know, 36
precise.
Hours precise. Okay. So what happens is that after which we'll take the patient to the operating theatre, the anaesthetist will give a sedation. The patient will be asleep for half an hour. So what we usually do is we'll do an ultrasound scan from down below, vaginally, put a needle through to collect the eggs. So the actual procedure is about the most 20 minutes, and after which the patient will wake up and go home.
Okay. So then you fertilise, the embryologist comes in, and
yes.
Of course you've got the sperm collected as well.
Yes, that's right.
Bring it together, and then there's an embryo transfer.
That's right.
How do you prepare the lining of the womb for this transfer?
Now, the lining of the womb is actually, there are two aspects to this. So it depends on whether you're doing a fresh transfer or a frozen transfer. Now, fresh transfer means that 3 to 5 days after egg collection, the embryos are grown to the day 3 stage or day 5 stage, then you put back the embryo on the same cycle after the egg collection. But nowadays, the trend is to do a frozen embryo transfer because patients find that more easy because they don't have to be bombarded with a lot of medication. And we statistics has shown that frozen embryo transfer has a slightly higher pregnancy rate compared to the fresh transfers. So if you are doing frozen transfers, you can either do it under a natural cycle, meaning that you wait until the woman ovulate naturally, and 3 days or 5 days after ovulation, you put back the embryo, or you can give them a medicated cycle, meaning that you give them medication to take, which mimics a natural ovulation.
Mm-hmm.
And then put back the embryos.
Okay.
Voila, just like that.
You make it sound so simple, honestly. I'm sure it's not.
It is quite simple, actually.
And we're paying you so much for it.
Oh, yes.
Okay. If you have a question, we're discussing fertility. WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or tweet us at PFM Radio. If you have a question, I'm Dr. Helena Lim, our fertility specialist in the studio with us. So once you've transferred it, how long does that process take to transfer the embryo?
You mean the actual procedure itself?
Yep.
It's actually probably about 5 to 10 minutes.
Okay.
That's actually very simple. So usually you do not need a sedation anymore. It's something just like a pap smear. You don't even feel it.
Just inserting it into the uterus. Let's talk about assisted reproductive technology. How do you monitor whether the results, you know, the results of the pregnancy, how do you keep monitoring and making sure that this, you know, fertilized egg is actually doing well?
Well, the thing is, now there are a few things that traditionally what we do is the embryologist would check after fertilization, after day one, so they will check whether the eggs are fertilized properly or not. Then they will actually recheck it at day three to see how many cells are there. Usually between day one to day three, the embryos should actually divide itself. The cells would divide into about 6 to 8 cells by day three. Now, after day three, it's actually quite interesting because all the cells will fuse together and then suddenly it goes into exponential growth. And then you become a blastocyst at day 5 or day 6. Now, a blastocyst actually consists of a few thousand cells. And that is the time whereby, we are more sure that the embryos are going to grow further if we put it into the mom's uterus. And this is actually the time there whereby we can have the opportunity to do a biopsy to look at, you know, to just take out 4 to 5 cells from the blastocyst to check for their chromosomes.
What is a blastocyst?
Blastocyst is day 5 embryo, which consists of about a few thousand cells.
And does it always happen? Does a blastocyst always happen?
Not necessarily. So if your embryo is actually of poor quality, sometimes it doesn't make it into day 5. And that is one of the way we select embryos, because we know that at day three, sometimes you can't make a very good decision which embryo is nicer. Mm-hmm. So what happens nowadays is that a lot of labs are now pushing for day five embryos, which is the blastocyst. So therefore, you culture them all the way to day five. Now, the reason why it's getting more popular is that a few years ago, to culture the day three embryo to day five was difficult because of the medium was not mature enough, the medium, the environment, the culture medium, as well as the equipments are not as good as what it was today.
Okay, so now it's a lot better.
Much better.
So what happens if there's no pregnancy?
Now, it is actually very tough because a lot of times patients come here, they pay a lot of money. And of course, they have their expectation. They expect to walk out here with a pregnancy and with a live baby. Now, sometimes it's very hard to manage everyone's expectation. And we all know that IVF is not 100% pregnant, 100% successful, mm-hmm. merely because not all the embryos that we make are actually chromosomally normal. So, in fact, I was looking at the statistics. If you are less than the age of 30, and if you have three blastocysts, only two are normal and one is chromosomally abnormal.
Meaning it made it up to day five.
Yeah, if you have three day five embryos. So if you're actually at the age of 40, you will find that two out of your three blastocysts is actually abnormal in chromosome. You only have one, which is normal. So that is actually the one. Why is that, pregnancy rate is much lower in an older woman compared to a younger woman? Yeah. So when the IVF is not successful, it didn't get you pregnant. Now, of course, patient will be disappointed. Well, we know that some, one or two will disappear into the sunset and then they will just hide their head in the, bury their head in the sand and they don't come up, because they will go into depression, mm-hmm. which sometimes we see as well. But we make a point to make all the patients come back to speak to us and to say to look at why it didn't work. And we look at, is there anything that we need to tweak in terms of your treatment cycle and what should we do next in order to improve your pregnancy rate?
I'm sure there are many instances where you don't know.
Yeah, certainly.
What's happened.
Correct.
How do you deal with that? Because then you don't even know what to fix.
Yeah. So what happens is, thank God that there are now more and more statistics that tell us a lot more things about what is, why IVF is successful or why it is not. Now, I know that what happens over the last 3 to 5 years is that all around the world, IVF labs and also certainly universities are now doing more and more genetic works. Now, what we call a pre-implantation genetic screening test. Now, we know that for a very, very certain fact that if I put back an embryo and this woman don't get pregnant, now, the 70 to 80% of the time, it is due to chromosome abnormalities of the blastocyst.
Right.
So another 20-30% is due to other factors such as uterus environment factors, such as excessive natural killer cell factors, such as immunity factors and certain other factors as well.
Okay.
So now it comes to, what is next?
And if it's positive?
If it's positive, then we have to monitor. In my approach is to actually see them every few weeks to make sure that their pregnancy go on well.
For how long do you monitor before you send them off to an obstetrician gynecologist? I mean, you are an obstetrician and gynecologist yourself.
Yeah.
But I know that a lot of times you sort of focus on fertility treatments,
yes, right.
And then send off your patients to deliver or to be followed up by a person who just does obstetrician and gynecology work.
Yeah. Now, what happens, my routine practice were to actually refer them to a fetal medicine specialist at about 12 weeks to ensure that the pregnancy is going well. Because not all patients require a pre-implantation genetic screening test. So really, sometimes you may not know that whether the pregnancy is associated with some chromosome abnormality such as Down syndrome and so forth. So usually I would suggest that they have a screening test, a first trimester screening test to look for all these fetal anomalies and so forth. And after which they come back to see me at week 15 or week 16, then I would generally ask them where would they like to go and who would they like to see to continue their antenatal care. So patients are usually very happy about that, and so are our colleagues, who feels that we are actually working together as a team.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. You focus on what you do best.
Yes.
And just continue getting people pregnant.
Yes, that's right.
You know, let's talk about the add-ons that in the UK they're referring to, the Human Fertilisation and Embryology Authority. Now, they are the regulators for fertility treatment in the UK. And they are saying now the most common add-ons in the UK include certain procedures. Now, what are these add-ons supposed to do? What are they supposed to do? Can you give me some examples?
Well, there are many, many, many add-ons from every aspect of IVF.
Like what, Dr. Helena? I mean, what are you actually doing?
Well, the thing is, you see, when we as fertility doctors have always have this pressure to actually make our patient pregnant, because we always want to improve our pregnancy rate. Mm-hmm. So therefore, you know, a lot of research, a lot of science are looking at, okay, number one, how do you actually improve the number of eggs you collect?
Right.
That's number one. How do you improve sperm, for example? How do you improve embryo quality? Okay. And how do you actually select which embryo to put in to actually make sure that the woman get pregnant? And certainly after, you know, putting back the embryo, is there anything I can do to the environment to make the embryo stick to the womb? What we call implantation. So in every aspect, there are many things that people look at. Now, to start with, there are many medications, for example, DHEA, which we sometimes prescribe for women who have very low ovarian reserve. Now, there have been studies to show that, yes, it improved the number of eggs we collected. It slightly improved the live birth rate. But again, this kind of medication, in the long run, does it actually cause any harm? Does it actually have any implication on your offspring in the second or third generation? Nobody knows, actually. So again, these are things like add-ons that we do. We do offer to patients who really needed it. Who really have very low ovarian reserve, for example.
But do you not think it's open for abuse, these add-ons? Because, you know, you find that patients are vulnerable. They are desperate. They want to have a child. And if you do recommend these add-ons, there's a high chance they probably buy in.
Yes. Unfortunately, like we said, that because in our field, because patients are so desperate, it's like cancer. You want it to get well. Yeah. You want to survive. And then sometimes there are multiple avenues which opens opens to abuse and open for manipulation as well. So therefore, we have to be very careful about how we speak to patients about, these are my suggestion. What other studies have shown? Again, science sometimes also behave in a very strange way, because what happens is that a lot of things that we do actually are incidental. Or somebody did something and then we observe that, maybe that helps. And people talk about it. People publish an observational study on that. Mm-hmm. And then people start to look at, hey, does it work or not in a clinical trial? So people start to look at, a small clinical trial by giving a group of women this medication and another group of women who doesn't receive the medication, and to see whether it makes any difference.
Yeah.
So sometimes when you have this kind of small study, it does show some positive results. But then if you actually do a very, very big trial, and sometimes the result will be negative or conflicting. So sometimes it's very hard for us to judge whether, you know, which paper to follow. Is a meta-analysis a paper, the paper to follow, or should we follow a randomized control trial? And sometimes you really need to look at, you know, the fine prints of each study to really make a decision that whether this is actually helping your patient or not.
Yeah, because it can make a big difference if it is indeed got basis for it.
Yeah, that's okay. Right.
We'll come back and find out more about fertility treatment. If you have a question for Dr. Helena Lim, WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. When we come back after the market update, we'll find out whether or not Malaysia has a regulator when it comes to fertility treatment. As far as I know, there is none. And what does that mean for fertility treatment and people who actually offer this as a service or, you know, consultation. Coming up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Mira Sivasothi. If you've just joined us, I am in the studio with me, Dr. Helena Lim, a fertility specialist, and we're discussing fertility add-ons and add-up. We've, of course, gone through the whole fertility 101 and what's needed and what happens during that process. But we're discussing the add-ons, where in the UK, the British Medical Journal, in the Human Fertilisation and Embryology Authority, who's the regulator in the UK, has called on for more transparency over add-on fertility treatments. And Dr. Helena has explained just now what some of these add-ons are. It's just basically tweaking and improving every step of the process of IVF to ensure better outcomes. However, it borders on whether or not these techniques are
useful or not.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, because we have the whole battery of everything, you know, from how we inject the sperm, how we select sperm, how we prepare the body, what food you take, what nutrients you take, even things like, you know, endometrial scratching, for example.
Or, what is that?
Okay, it is actually a procedure to be done on women who have recurrent implantation failure. Yeah, what happens is that we scratch the, we do a very, very a small procedure by scratching the lining of the uterus, or even you can even offer them a hysteroscope, which is putting a scope through the cervix to look at the uterus lining. And it actually creates a sterile inflammation so that it attracts a lot of cytokines and all the hormones and growth factors to help the uterus become more receptive of pregnancy.
So it takes on...
Yeah, there is actually three good studies that shows that hey, it helps marginally to improve pregnancy rate. But in those women are the women who have recurrent implantation issue, meaning that you have put two or three times, two to three embryos back into your uterus and they didn't get pregnant at all. So that is actually that group of patients. But however, does it, you know, extrapolate to patients who just had one embryo transfer and then didn't get pregnant? Should they have an endometrial scratching or not? Nobody knows. And again, recently, there's another paper from Hong Kong which suggests that it doesn't make any difference at all. So really, you really scratch your head and say, look, you know, where do we draw the line?
So the HFEA is calling for more transparency. What does that mean? So what does that mean? You talk to your patients more, go through all these studies with them. Chances are most people are not going to do that.
Yeah, because it takes a long time to tell patients, you know, ABC, because there's so many add-ons available here. So I would think that they are trying to actually encourage all the doctors to come up with a guideline or come up with a consensus. Is it useful? Is it not useful? Mm-hmm. And so forth. But you see, science is an ever-changing thing, because what is popular today may not be the right thing to do in the next 5 years or next 10 years. So really, you know, when you talk about transparency and, you know, whether it's doable or not is another question, ball game.
Just trying to decide whether to eat butter or not.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Like with the butter story.
Yeah. Question from CT. I would like to ask if the IVF success rate is higher if the mother has a baby before, or is it compared, how does that compare to a first-time mother?
Sure. There are three main factors that determines whether this woman is actually at a higher pregnancy rate or not. The first thing is their age. Age, it remains one of the biggest factor when it comes to IVF success rate. Number two, if you had a child before, your chances of pregnancy with an IVF is slightly higher than a person who is same age as you, same profile as you, and had not had a child before. So that is number two. Number three is the duration of subfertility with that particular couple. So the longer you actually have suffer from subfertility, the lower chance of you getting pregnant with IVF.
So don't wait too long between the last pregnancy.
Exactly.
And the IVF.
That's right.
If you're thinking about it. But then again, most would think of IVF
as a last resort.
Exactly, because you've already had one child.
Yes, that's right.
And you would assume you would get naturally pregnant once again.
Yeah, that's actually, again, that is actually a misconception, because people think that their fertility remains the same, you know, as 10 years ago. Well, our body changes all the time. Okay, we aged. Our egg number goes down. Certainly along the line, things happen. For example, infection can happen that destroy your fallopian tube, for example. Or you have things like fibroid or endometriosis, again, which reduces your fertility rate. Your husband may be very stressed. He smoke and drink like a fish. And that actually reduces his sperm quality.
Yes.
All right.
And sperm quality throughout the world has dropped.
Absolutely. And I'm blaming the our air pollution and our food chain and our water.
Environment,
yeah. I think all this play a part.
In the man's sperm count.
Yeah.
Do you believe that it's halved over the last 50 years?
I would think so, because in a French study, over the last 30 years, that there has been a significant reduction in men's sperm in France. You know, France.
Yes.
Yes. Ah.
Okay. So, Malaysia, I mean, do you see more and more men coming in with fertility issues?
Absolutely, yeah. When we started IVF in Malaysia, I would think that the statistics for male infertility would be somewhere between 20 to 30%. But nowadays, we are seeing an increasing number of male issues, male factors. So again, this is something that we are all concerned about. And sometimes I do sit there and wonder, what will become of our next generation? Yeah. Does everyone need IVF eventually?
Oh, dear.
Oh, yes.
Oh, dear.
Oh, yes.
You know, that it's a very lucrative business, right? We know it is. It's costly, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And you have a lot of people jumping on the bandwagon.
Absolutely.
Wanting to get into this fertility treatment business. But who's regulating it, Dr. Helena? We don't have a regulator like the Human Fertilization and Embryology Authority. And what does that mean for Malaysia?
Well, Malaysia is actually, not to say it's not entirely regulated. Yes, we are under the umbrella of Ministry of Health. So Ministry of Health do have certain guidelines and requirements for building an IVF lab, for example. You know, the expertise has to be there. You have to adhere to certain guidelines. Your facility has to be properly built, as well as it follows certain standardization. And your doctors has to be trained and so forth. Your nurses are supposed to be trained and so forth. Now, that is the first thing. Now, however, we still do not have a law that governs certain issues. For example, things like, you know, egg and sperm donation for that matter. All right. We also have a lot of issue when it comes to, you know, whether egg freezing, for example, or sperm freezing is allowed or not allowed in certain, you know, certain religious group, for example, or certain racial group, for example. So I think these are the issues that we need to iron out. And I'm looking forward. I have heard that the law is coming because it has been drafted quite a number of years ago, and is supposed to be presented in the parliament and be debated. Well, I'm looking forward because I know that the new government is actually very keen to get a lot of things going.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Okay. So that's something that should be done.
Done. Yes, exactly. Because again, I feel at a personal level, I feel very uncomfortable with certain practices in some of our fertility services.
Mm-hmm.
Namely, for example, you know, the donor eggs and donor sperm, for example. Now, I'm not saying that it's wrong, but I felt that, you know, it has to be regulated in some way. For example, in Australia, for example, if you want to have a donor egg or donor sperm, for that matter, you have to actually be done under a registry, meaning that there's regulator who will actually moderate, you know, what is appropriate and what is not appropriate. So, for example, if a woman actually decides to donate her eggs and it causes 5 pregnancies already, she has to stop so that it reduces the risk of consanguinity in the offspring and so forth. In Malaysia, sadly, it's not this kind of, we still do not have this kind of registry for that matter. And we need this kind of registry to regulate our practices and the implication of our society.
Yeah. So just very basics, going back to the basics, not even coming to the procedure as such.
Exactly, yeah.
So when it comes to the add-ons, how do we empower people, or even just not add-ons, in terms of fertility treatment, how do we empower people to ask the right questions?
Well, the thing is, I think a lot of times, I always tell patients that not everything you read online is the gospel. Yeah, I know that a lot of patients, they like to share their experience. They'll go online to tell people that, oh, I've done this with this doctor. She gave me this, or he gave me this, and therefore I'm pregnant. And that must be the reason why I get pregnant with the IVF, because I did something. Well, sometimes it's very difficult to quantify whether this is something that really made a difference for you or not, because sometimes it's how you feel. And we read about placebo effect, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. Sometimes, all the time.
All the time. It makes you happy. But the principle of things is, number one, do no harm, meaning that whatever add-on that that you requested or the doctors suggested, it has to be. We need to actually establish whether it harms you or not in the long run. So that's number one. Do no harm. All right. If it's not harming you, yes, it may be useful, then you may want to consider whether this is actually something suitable for you or not.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So that's very much the gauge, isn't it?
Yes, that's okay. Right.
We're running out of time. Would you have a message for us on fertility?
Well, again, the message for the year of boar is to always come in early for a check. Yeah, again, age is a factor, and prevention is actually better than cure, for example. So I would encourage those who are struggling to trying to have a baby to step forward and to come in for a chat with us.
Okay, just come and chat first.
Yes, come and chat with us.
History taking, you never
exactly
know. You might be the 10 to 20%, did you say?
Yes.
Who actually may not need any intervention at all.
Absolutely.
Just get the dates correct.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much for joining us today. Dr. Helena Lim, fertility specialist, speaking to us about do fertility, does it add on, add-ons, do they add up on the bigger picture? BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.